Welcome to The Bridge, a twice-weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgane, your host for the show. The stigma of living with a mental illness can complicate efforts to maintain an ordinary work, home, and social life. This morning, we'll hear from Oregon State Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward. She'll share her experience as a family care physician who also manages her own chronic mental illness. Also on the show, a 22-year-old graffiti artist from Tillamook now lives on the streets of Olympia, Washington.
I feel like it's just really easy to get by here with no struggle. You know, like, we've got places that give us food, clothing when we need it, shelter if we really do need it. There's places you can go.
But the life with no struggle came to a violent end last October for another young man on the street. Austin Jenkins talks to street youth in Olympia about their way of life. That story coming up in about 6 minutes. This is Coast Community Radio. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio in top local and regional stories this morning. A helicopter company that transports bar pilots at the mouth of the Columbia River wants a management role at Astoria's Regional Airport in Warrenton. Brim Aviation of Ashland took over the bar pilot work last year from a California company. Bar pilots guide ocean-going vessels over the treacherous passage at the mouth of the river. Brim's maintenance base manager, Kyle Fortune, tells the Daily Astorian the company will make its proposal tonight to the Port of Astoria. The port recently laid off its part-time airport manager to save money. Fortune says Brim would take over fueling, fixed base operation, and other services. It wants to provide 24-hour fuel service as well as courtesy cars for pilots and regional marketing for the airport. Backers of an Oregon plan to replace the Interstate 5 bridge across the Columbia River hope to get a special session of the state legislature as soon as this month to pass a new plan to finance the project. The Oregonian reports the new financing plan relies heavily on tolls, more than $1 billion worth. The project has been in doubt since the Washington legislature decided against putting up $450 million to match Oregon's contribution. But proponents, such as Democratic Representative Tobias Reed of Beaverton, says the project is still needed. Governor John Kitzhaber is a backer, as are business and labor groups. It faces a variety of skeptics, including Washington State residents opposed to including light rail trains as part of the project. The Eugene-Springfield Metropolitan Wastewater Management Commission is trying to give away millions of gallons a day of treated sewage. So far, no takers. The Register Guard reports the agency hopes to reduce the 30 million gallons a day it pumps into the Willamette River. The problem is the temperature of the effluent. It violates standards for fish for about a third of the year. The agency had hoped to give treated water to nearby Delta Sand and Gravel to wash sand and gravel, control dust, and make concrete. After considering the idea, the company declined because of health and quality control concerns. It draws its water from the river. The sewage treatment plan may pump more of the water into poplar tree plantations it owns north of Eugene. On Friday, Columbia Memorial Hospital, the City of Astoria, and Friends of the Astoria Column will host a community pink out at the base of the Astoria Column. The event will include brief speeches by breast cancer survivors. The column will be lit by pink lights, and participants can launch small gliders from the top of the column in hope or memory of loved ones. Complimentary gliders can be picked up this week from the Columbia Memorial Hospital Primary Care Clinic in Warrenton, the West Lobby of the hospital, or the information desk of the CMH Health and Wellness Pavilion. The event will take place Friday at 6 p.m. October is National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. At Washington's State Capitol campus in Olympia, sandstone buildings stand as monuments to the rule of law. But just a few blocks away, you can find a street culture where young adults and teenagers live by their own rules, sometimes with tragic consequences. An especially grisly murder last year revealed an underworld in Washington's capital city that can sound almost Lord of the Flies. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins reports.
Olympia Police Lieutenant Paul Lauer leads me through a blackberry bramble-covered trail to the scene of the crime.
So this is the general area right in here.
It's a trash-strewn former homeless camp along Interstate 5 in East Olympia. It's here that last October, a 17-year-old named Forrest Snow Bailey, who went by the street name Sonic, was stabbed to death.
They ended up in the end trying to hide what they had did by burning the victim's body in a barrel out here.
Police found the burned remains and quickly arrested a prime suspect who was 19 at the time, Christopher Lee Harrison, known as Schizo on the streets of Olympia. Two alleged accomplices, Red and Discord, were also arrested. Jessica Alf was in drug rehab when she got the news.
I got a call saying that Schizo had killed Sonic, and I flipped out.
Alf, who goes by the street name Joker, knew both young men. For her, the murder felt like a crime within the family.
And it is. It's a street family. We're tight.
Alf is a longtime client of Community Youth Services in Olympia, where Charles Chelan is CEO. He says it's common for runaways and other disaffected youth to replace the family they ran away from with a street family.
And they will normally call other people their brothers or their mother or their father, but they won't be biologically related to them whatsoever. And sometimes that's really can be very positive, and sometimes it could be a disaster as well.
On the streets of Washington's capital city, you can also find more formal alliances. Jessica Alf, Joker, is 22, and she identifies herself as a Juggalo. That's the name given to followers of the Detroit-based rap group Insane Clown Posse.
We have watched each other's back. We're always with each other. I don't know if you've ever heard around the street, we say whoop whoop, which means I can.
These kids are living outside the bounds of what we would consider society, I guess.
Patrick O'Connor is a public defender who represents the man accused of committing last fall's homeless camp murder. O'Connor wouldn't talk about this specific case, but he says over the years he's defended dozens of young adults living on the streets of Olympia.
What we've seen is that they, in a way, are forming their own society with a kind of a hierarchy of members where some people have some authority in a community to set rules, and the younger members follow the rules.
O'Connor allows it's a little like the novel-turned-movie Lord of the Flies.
Halt! Who goes there?
Don't be stupid! You know who we are! We've fought the cops, and I'm calling an assembly!
It's not just Olympia. Street youth are fixtures in small northwest cities from Bellingham to Eugene to Ashland. In Olympia's Thurston County, more than a third of the homeless are 25 and under. That doesn't count the young faces you see on the street during the day, but who couch surf at night. Olympia especially seems to be a magnet for street youth. It's a funky liberal town home to the Evergreen State College, where alternative feels like the mainstream. There's also a myth about Olympia's artesian water fountain downtown. If you drink from it, you'll never leave Olympia.
It's the water. That's what it is. It's the artesian well water. I blame it on that.
James is a 22-year-old graffiti artist from Tillamook, Oregon. I found him in a graffiti-covered alleyway less than a mile from the state capitol. When I pressed James about why he was really here, he offered a different answer.
I feel like it's just really easy to get by here with no struggle. You know, like, we've got places that give us food, clothing when we need it, shelter if we really do need it. There's places you can go. I mean, there's ordinances where you can't sit on the streets, but, you know, there's ways to abide by that where you don't get bothered.
In fact, several of the youth I spoke with said they feel safer in a smaller city like Olympia than in Portland or Seattle, but they also complained that trust within the street family has broken down recently, mostly because of rampant drug use, meth, and lately heroin. Police say they've seen more drug-related violence, too. Charles Chelan at Community Youth Services says last fall's homeless camp murder was a galvanizing event. In response, he secured emergency funding to open a seasonal 10-bed overnight shelter.
We know if that young man would have had a safe place to stay and chosen to stay there, he would be alive today.
That murder hit especially close to home for Chelan and his staff. Court records indicate the accused, Christopher Harrison, was a client at Community Youth Services. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
Chances are that someone you know has experienced mental illness. A U.S. Health and Human Services Agency study says 1 in 5 Americans experienced some kind of mental illness in 2010. About 5% of Americans have suffered from such severe mental illness that it interfered with day-to-day school, work, or family. The stigma of living with a mental illness can complicate efforts to maintain an ordinary work, home, and social life. On Saturday, Oregon State Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward spoke to Astorians about her experiences living with and managing her own chronic mental illness.
For some people like me, it's a chronic illness just like diabetes, right? And if you have somebody who has type 1 diabetes, which means the kind where it usually starts when you're young and your body doesn't make enough insulin, which is the hormone we use to use sugar properly in our bodies, they have to use insulin every single day to keep their blood sugar normal, right? And for me, my brain doesn't make enough of a neurotransmitter, a hormone in my brain called norepinephrine, right? And I know this because the drug that I take every single day is a norepinephrine drug to help my brain have more of it. And when I take that drug, I'm a very, very functional, highly functioning, engaged person who's able to serve her community in a lot of different ways, which is pretty important to me, right? If I don't, then after a couple days of missing it, I start to wonder whether getting out of bed in the morning is worthwhile. And if I do, taking a shower seems like an awful lot of work, and eating seems like even more work. And so asking me to pull myself up by my bootstraps and make sure that I, you know, say that I could be cured by getting enough exercise and eating right and having a strong spiritual life, well, that'd be like telling a type 1 diabetic, gee, if you only did all those things, then you wouldn't need your insulin. It's exactly the same. And while we don't know specifically, for example, for people with schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or whatever, we don't know exactly which hormones or neurotransmitters are involved, they're equally genetic, right? People do not choose to have chronic mental illness. I would choose not to have this if I could avoid it. But it's a fact of my life. And the more we can talk about that openly, the more we can understand that it's very possible with the right treatment to live a productive, engaged, active life.
Hayward serves on the Senate Health and Human Services Policy Committee. In April of this year, during a committee meeting, she announced she has suffered from major depression for 15 years. Since then, she's worked to open up conversations about living with mental illness.
The only way we're going to start changing this is to have these conversations openly and see that the sky doesn't fall. Some of you in the room are old enough to remember the McGovern campaign, and when I called home and told my husband, so I talked about this publicly today, he said, I have two words for you, and that's Thomas Eagleton, right? I mean, some of you may remember that Eagleton was McGovern's first choice for his vice presidential candidate, and because Eagleton had been treated for depression, he basically had to bow out. And it became a huge public brouhaha. The good news is I have gotten nothing but positive feedback for being open about this. And now I'm having opportunities like this. And I have gotten email and snail mail and stopped in hallways to this. I mean, it's been 6 months and people are still stopping me. And I'm so touched by that, because if I can give a few more people the courage to say, hey, me too, and look, I'm normal, because we are.
As a physician, Hayward said she has worked to spread understanding that living with chronic mental illness does not mean a person doesn't have a normal sense of reality or is necessarily violent. Most often, expressions of violence mean the person involved has not received the right care. But getting the right care can mean getting over perception roadblocks, even among care providers.
I'll tell you a story that really illustrates the challenge that physicians have faced dealing with mental health. A while back, maybe 12 or 15 years ago, I had a patient in my practice who, among other challenges, had bipolar disorder. Pretty significant, on medication in a supported living situation. And her medication, she got unstable. And she got admitted to a local hospital in Portland to the psychiatric unit to help her get stabilized and stay safe while she was getting stabilized. She also had some medical things, and I needed to do a little procedure on her. I needed to do a D&C on her to make sure that we weren't dealing with another health issue. Because one of the problems we face, by the way, is that people living with mental health, mental illnesses, often have very poor care of their physical illnesses, and so we really have to make a point. People with chronic mental health issues, especially severe persistent mental illness, die on average 25 years earlier than people without in part because they don't get their other medical needs attended to. Anyway, so I set this woman up to do her DNC while she was in the hospital because she was stable enough at that point that it was a good time to do it, and I didn't want her to have to come in separately. Went into the OR area, pre-op, was waiting for her, and at some point one of the nurses came up and said, "When's your patient coming in?" She was supposed to be checking in already, and I said, "She's in the hospital. What do you mean, when's she coming in? She's supposed to be coming down from the floor." "Well, there's no record of her being in the hospital." And the answer is, the records for the psychiatric ward were kept completely separate. We weren't treating it like any other illness. And so it's become a vicious cycle, right? We worry about the stigma, so we separate out psychiatric records from regular, quote-unquote, regular medical records. And then because they're separated, it means that it enhances the stigma.
Hayward says there have been some recent advances. This year, Oregon-funded programs designed to attract and retain more healthcare professionals for the state, including mental health providers. In addition, monies derived from the cigarette tax enacted during the special legislative session will go exclusively to mental health.
And that looks like $20 million this biennium alone. And we're going to start primarily with kids, because as I said, when we front-load the system, when we make sure that kids get the care that they need, our whole communities are better off. Our whole communities are healthier. So I think we're starting to make some progress. It's not perfect, but we're making progress.
Oregon State Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward was the featured speaker at Saturday's Lower Columbia Diversity Project's community conversation about mental illness. Still coming up, good economic news in the beer business. In 1978, there were 48 breweries in America. Now there are 2,600 breweries.
The future of craft brewing looks bright, and what's good for the craft brewer, at least in the last few years, has been good for the hop grower. So, and we look forward to continued good times for both of those industries.
But how many craft breweries can make it over the long haul? Anna King reports from Washington's Yakima Valley. That story just after this weather break. The time is nearly 9:20. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia coastal region. Today, sunny with highs in the high 60s, east winds 5 to 8 miles per hour. Tonight, patchy fog after 11 p.m., otherwise partly cloudy with lows in the low 40s. Gordon McCraw, meteorologist and director of Tillamook Emergency Management, says except for the chilly nighttime temperatures, it looks like fall has been put on hold until a strong stationary high-pressure area to our west breaks down and moves on, which doesn't look like it will happen anytime this week. We'll have sunny and mild days through the weekend with highs hovering from just below to just above 70, though we'll see some patchy morning fog for most of the week, which burns off mid to late morning. The morning lows stay in the upper 30s to low 40s, and the winds keep an easterly component most of the week. The one flaw this week, some of the models suggest we could see some overnight cloudiness with possible morning drizzle tonight into tomorrow. Otherwise, mostly clear nights prevail. The high pressure may start to break down over the weekend, according to some models, but others keep it strong, continuing to push any rain well north of the area into the start of next week. The U.S. Supreme Court is just over a week into its new term, despite the federal government shutdown. The new round of legal cases will likely continue a pattern of closely divided rulings. But every once in a while, decisions from the highest court in the land are unanimous. That happened last year when the justices ruled in favor of an Idaho couple challenging federal environmental regulations. Now correspondent Jessica Robinson finds the ruling hasn't solved their problems, nor has it had the big policy impact that was predicted.
In the fall of 2011, Mike and Chantel Sackett showed me around a lot they owned near Priest Lake in the Idaho Panhandle. You could still see piles of dirt and gravel where work had started on their house.
Basically, we worked 3 days, and this is where we got to. We were actually, the next day, the concrete guy was going to start the foundation, but that never happened.
That's because the Environmental Protection Agency told the Sacketts they were building on a wetland. The compliance order the agency issued threatened tens of thousands of dollars in fines per day, and the Sacketts couldn't challenge the order. This is how Chantel Sackett described a phone call with one EPA official.
I said, "So why would I stop building my house?" She said, "Because we told you to."
A few months later, at oral argument, the justices did not hide that they sympathized with the Sacketts. Justice Samuel Alito pressed the government's attorney.
"Well, so what? Somebody from the EPA says, we think that your backyard is a wetlands. so don't build. Well, so what does the homeowner do?
Once that property?
Well, all right, I'm just going to put it aside as a nature preserve.
At the time that
3 months later, the ideologically divided court, in a case involving the contentious Clean Water Act, no less, issued a unanimous ruling. The Sacketts won. They had the right to challenge the EPA's compliance order. Fast forward now to the present. The lot near Priest Lake in Idaho is still vacant. The piles of dirt and gravel, unmoved.
Maybe the weeds might be a little taller, but it just basically looks the same.
I reached Mike Sackett in North Dakota, where he's now working for a gravel company. He visits Chantel back in Idaho about once a month. The Sacketts are back in court. They're arguing with the EPA about the next step.
You would think that after beating them 9-0, that they would want to negotiate and get the thing done and let us get on with their lives. But instead, you know, we're still dealing with the EPA in our lives.
The reason has to do with the very crux of the original case. The issue before the Supreme Court wasn't whether the Sacketts' land contained wetlands. It was whether the Sacketts should have the chance to argue whether the Sacketts' land contained wetlands. And that's exactly where they are now. It's a slow process, which brings us to the question of what the Sackett case means for environmental regulations. Conservationists worried the Clean Water Act would be far weaker if the EPA had to defend all its compliance orders against polluters in court. But the agency may have a way around that. If you go back and listen to the oral arguments at the Supreme Court, Justice Antonin Scalia, in a quick aside, predicted an alternative to compliance orders.
They'll just issue warnings is what they'll do.
Warnings, like a sternly worded letter.
If the agency's smart, he's dead right, frankly. And I don't say that very often about Justice Scalia in the environmental realm, but I think he understands that the agency has other mechanisms at its disposal to threaten people.
Craig Johnston is an environmental law professor at Lewis and Clark in Portland. As he and others expected, the Supreme Court determined that compliance orders are subject to judicial review. But the justices didn't say anything about less formal warning letters. These have less bite, but still the same bark.
Most people would never know the difference. You know, it wouldn't be until they talked to their lawyer, and even then it would have to be a good lawyer to even explain the difference between the two.
Johnston says, in the end, Sackett v. EPA may just turn out to be a speed bump. Of course, it still depends on what the EPA decides to do. Requests for comment were not returned before the government shut down. I'm Jessica Robinson, reporting.
Northwest farmers are wrapping up this year's hop harvest at a time when the craft beer industry is seeing huge growth. The change in America's beer drinking habits means hop farmers are selling more of their crop to smaller breweries than ever before. But all this success begs the question, is there a craft brew bubble? Correspondent Anna King sought answers in Washington's Yakima Valley.
Patrick Smith is a fourth-generation hop farmer. He guides me inside his family's hop-drying plant. Imagine a grocery store filled with nothing but hop beds 2.5 feet deep.
So the green hops come in from the picking machine.
Massive heaters blow air up through the bright green hops.
Wow, it's like a high-priced sauna in here.
Yeah, it's pretty humid. We've got to drive off tens of thousands of pounds of moisture in each one of these beds.
Smith says he uses some of the same technology his grandfather did, but now the customers are very different, and so is the product. His family used to grow mostly alpha hops to extract a bitter oil for large-scale breweries. Now, Smith's family grows mostly aroma hops for craft breweries. Those are less bitter and have more complex flavors.
The United States hop industry is rapidly shifting acreage away from alpha hops to aroma hops to meet that growing demand.
Get this. In 1978, there were 48 breweries in America. Now there are 2,600 breweries. Smith says he'll see where the family stands a few years down the road.
But for now, the future of craft brewing looks bright. And what's good for the craft brewer, at least in the last few years, has been good for the hop grower. So. And we look forward to continued good times for both of those industries.
The Smith family thinks so much of the craft brew business. They've started their own, right on the hop farm. It comes in cans, not bottles. Smith's sister, Megan Quinn, says they can't keep up with demand since opening in April.
So we have two more fermenters coming. They should actually arrive in about 2 weeks.
So that will increase, it'll actually double the amount of beer we can produce out of this facility, which will be good.
But will the growth of craft breweries come to a head? Julia Herz with the National Brewers Association says no. There's still more room than supply.
We get asked a lot, should there be more breweries? And that'd be like asking the National Restaurant Association, should there be another restaurant down the street? And the answer would naturally be, of course, if they can make world-class product and differentiate themselves, they absolutely will be able to, you know, service their customers.
And that demand will have a lasting impact on the beer industry. Joshua Bernstein is a New York-based writer and book author who specializes in beer. He says younger customers don't tend to go back to traditional beers after trying more local craft brews.
When you're 21, you have a great IPA and you understand what a great beer is. You know, you can make your distinction. You're going to want to have maybe your Bud Light, and that's totally fine. But you understand what a quality beer is at a much younger age.
Bernstein says, just as with food, another top trend in craft brew is the careful sourcing of hops, barley, and wheat. There are already several craft breweries in the Northwest growing their own ingredients, just like Balebreaker. Patrons there can see the hop harvest happening just outside the brewery's windows. I'm Anna King in Moxie, Washington.
That's all for today's edition of The Bridge. The Bridge airs Tuesday and Thursday mornings at 9. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Join us Thursday morning for a talk with Gordon McCraw from Tillamook Emergency Management about the Great Oregon Shakeout Earthquake Drill taking place that morning at 10:17. We'll hear how tsunami readiness is now a standard part of earthquake emergency planning on the coast. Thanks for listening this morning. We welcome your feedback on the show. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1, that's NEWS, then the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.